Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. I remember several years ago, maybe 15 or so, I was speaking to a good friend of mine who was very influenced by the life of the great Hindu yogi master Paramhansa Yogananda. And he was saying that there was something missing from Yogananda's work, and that is somebody needed to write a book on his life. Now, Yogananda had already written in 1946 Autobiography of a Yogi, which is a great spiritual classic. It still sells extremely well even today. And so my friend was saying, but there was so much left out of it. Somebody needs to write a book, but it shouldn't be a disciple of Yogananda. But at the same time, it shouldn't be just some journalist somewhere, or some author who gets an inkling that this might be a good idea. It needs to be somebody who has a really good understanding of the Indian spiritual traditions, but not someone closely connected to Yogananda. And I agreed. I thought, that's a good idea. Well, years later, the dream comes true. Sadly, my friend never lived to see this day, but I'm sure somewhere he's smiling because we now have a brand new book entitled The Life of Yogananda, The Story of the Yogi Who Became the First Modern Guru. And its author is Philip Goldberg. Phil has been on the show several times. Back in 2010, he released American Veda, which has already become a modern classic. And we're thrilled to have him this week. We had him last week, and we started talking about this book, The Life of Yogananda, and he has graciously assented to blessing us with his presence today by way of telephone as we speak to him in sunny Southern California. So, Phil, welcome back to Common Threads.
Hi, Fred. Great to be back.
Last week, we talked a little bit, well, we talked about the whole project, the massive project of trying to put the life of someone like Yogananda inside a book like this. And then we discussed a little bit of his early life. Tell us perhaps some of the other elements of his life. For instance, when we left last week, I seem to recall you talking about him leaving Boston, which is where he landed and established a small work there. And then he left cross country. He did a lot of, I think he called them campaigns, if I remember correctly. And he filled a lot of houses. Is that right?
Yes. You know, it started off small. You know, he started off doing, you know, small gatherings in people's living rooms or, you know, a rented facility in Boston. But as his reputation grew and as he garnered support from prominent people who knew how to make things happen and people who knew how to advertise and all that sort of thing, he started filling halls. By the mid-20s, it was not uncommon for him to, you know, have a few thousand people in certain places. And when he took off for his cross-country trip with the goal of ending up in Los Angeles, because he kind of knew that was where his headquarters would be, that's where he would find a permanent U.S. location. Even on that cross-country trip in Denver, in Seattle, in Portland, San Francisco, you know, he filled large concert halls with 2,000-3,000 people. And when his first lecture in L.A. in January of 1925, it was at Los Angeles Philharmonic Auditorium, which seats 3,000 people. And according to the newspapers, about twice that many showed up, and half of them had to be turned away. And so there was, you know, he was The LA Times called him the 20th century's first superstar guru. And that's that holds up historically. You know, there were superstar gurus in the 60s and 70s. We, you know, those of us old enough remember, when the Beatles went to India and Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was a superstar guru, and there were others. And but Yogananda was a superstar in the 20s and 30s and 40s and attracting large numbers of people. And he spent a great deal of time in those early years, in the 20s and into the 30s, on the road. He was traveling a lot. Even after they established a permanent facility in Los Angeles, he just kept traveling. And that's what was he felt was required of him to reach large numbers of people and start to get students who could grow into leadership representing him themselves, and to acquire, to generate the income that the organization needed. So, you know, he was out there giving lectures and teaching classes.
And what do you suppose were the real drawing qualities here in Christian America in the 1920s and 30s? Why were people going to see this Hindu monk?
You know, one of the things I say in American Veda is the teachings that we think of as Hinduism and Buddhism that are really that stem from the ancient Indian source that gave us Vedanta philosophy and yoga. The teachings that you find in the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads, these are classic eternal teachings that have application anywhere, any culture, regardless of people's religious orientation or belief. So they're often presented as scientific methods of developing human consciousness and developing strong minds and bodies, and a worldview that can be understood as philosophical or scientific, or as, you know, a set of hypotheses about how the universe works, not as religious dogma. And so Yogananda was one of the many gurus who presented the teachings in that way, as not something religious that one had to convert to if they wanted to avail themselves of it, but as something they can apply to their own lives, whether they were devout Christians or Jews or atheists or, you know, sort of secular self-improvement type of people. And he attracted all those people who found, what he was teaching not incompatible with the way they saw the world, and maybe filled in gaps in, you know, their questions and their doubts. America's always a seeking kind of culture. We want more happiness, more satisfaction, more intelligence, more wisdom, more knowledge, anything that can improve our lives. And we usually think of that in material terms. I need more money, I need more acquisition, I need better education, whatever it is. Here was a way of self-improvement that was internal, and that's what the sort of yogic teachings introduced to America. And he was coming on the heels. It's not that he came here in a vacuum in 1920. His great predecessor, Swami Vivekananda, had come and established organizations and some legacy in the 1890s. He just didn't stay very long. But Swamis in his lineage were already present in America. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thoreau, Madame Blavatsky, the whole what came to be called the New Thought movement, had already made a lot of inroads and had, you know, introduced the core teachings that came to us from India. And so there were already a lot of people interested in these things and to some degree or another looking into them. And now here was a great representative of it who had great ability and eloquence in English and a great presence, a very charismatic figure. And so there was a natural audience for it, and that just grew as the teachings had value. And people, Americans are very pragmatic. They try something. If it works, they embrace it and tell their friends. So, that's what it was. And they're all enthusiastic people, largely women, we should make clear, who became enthusiastic followers and opened a lot of doors, wrote checks, rented halls, bought advertising. And so, you know, but none of this would have happened if the practices he introduced did not improve people's lives. And that's a sort of bottom line of why these teachings and his teachings in his case of Yogananda caught on and spread.
Last week you mentioned him having to face racism. And I remember in the documentary Awake, which you, of course, contributed to as a commentator. So there was the racism, and then there was also, and as part of the racism, simply because some people didn't like dark people, there was also one of the controversies. You've mentioned there were controversies, and you mentioned that there were a lot of women involved in this work, and there were a lot of men who were concerned that not just Yogananda, but Indian teachers of other traditions were preying upon the purity of our white women.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. That did happen. And, you know, Yogananda probably was unaware that this was going on even before he arrived because, you know, there were some yoga teachers who would come and go, and there were the swamis from Swami Vivekananda's lineage running Vedanta Society centers in major cities, and they had students, and they were teaching. And as now, in the modern yoga world, the majority of students tended to be women. The men were, you know, busy doing their work and so forth. So women who had means and maybe a little free time and disposable income would be, you know, exploring things culturally and spiritually. And so the backlash, you know, sort of always there. So he was, these swamis were not only dark-skinned and therefore, you know, inferior in people's eyes or suspect, but they were what in those days was called Orientals. And so they were, you know, thought to be inscrutable, and they had mind power, and they could deceive and pull the wool over the eyes of gullible women who would find them charismatic and were easily hypnotizable, and all this kind of stuff that was laid on them. And on top of it all, they were heathen. You know, they were non-Christians. They were preaching false religion from a primitive culture that needed supervision by the British. You know, all of these crazy stereotypes went into it. I have a photo section in my book, and one of the images in here is from the Washington Post in 1912, a big headline that reads, "American Women, Victims of Hindu Mysticism." So, yes, he stepped into that, and there were accusations about him and his Indian associate, who a fellow swami he brought here to help him in the work. And, you know, these were lurid headlines that the Hearst chain of newspapers, which, you know, sort of was the definition of what was called yellow journalism, the original fake news, you could say, you know, they really cashed in on this, you know, lurid front page headlines, angry husbands, irate husbands, and, you know, doing this, and the truth is, you know, this had a big effect. And it was very distressing for Yogananda and his people to deal with. And in the late 20s, 1928, he found himself in Miami with a full schedule of classes and lectures. And all of a sudden, the police chief and others were asking him to leave because there were irate husbands who wanted him out of here. They didn't want their wives exposed to this. And it was a big court case. And it, you know, ended up in newspapers, syndicated all around the country, and ultimately, against his better judgment, they prevailed upon him to leave to protect his own safety. So, you know, this was life in those days. You know, one is in 1924 or 5, there were about 4 million members of the Ku Klux Klan in America, and they had rallies in Washington where, you know, 40,000 or 50,000 people would march. So this was, heavily racist time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and Philip Goldberg is my guest. He is the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. Last week, Phil, we talked about how this book came to be, your work with Yogananda's organization, Self-Realization Fellowship. And you said that you had to deal with writing about some of the controversies. And I'm assuming that you might mean both controversies that perhaps have been settled and some that remain open to this very day. Give us an example of what might have been a challenge in finding evidence
one way or the other. The main one, there were a lot of little things, but the main one was there are people who to this day, Yogananda was a swami. He took renunciate vows as a celibate and, you know, with associated vows as a young man. You know, he was in his early 20s. And here, in the roaring 20s, which was, you know, a kind of precursor to this, what we think of as the, you know, 60s, here he was teaching and, you know, all these American women and, you know, it was a more permissive culture and a more permissive time. And so people find it hard to believe that he would have maintained his vow of celibacy in those circumstances with close female disciples and all that. And so out of that kind of assumption and imagining, plus circumstances that could easily lend themselves to speculation, and, people to this day argue over whether Yogananda was having affairs with certain of his disciples. And these things were printed in newspapers at the time as well. And there were certain people around him in those days who accused him of that. And there are people who think he fathered children clandestinely. And so I had to write about all this stuff because it's out there. It's on the internet. It's a small number of people, but people are passionate about these things. And you see arguments about it all the time, and people are presenting their evidence. And I sifted through it all. I was wide open. If I found convincing evidence, you know, I would have revealed it. But I didn't. And so the bottom line on my research is, there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of inference, there's a lot of imagination, there are a lot of unanswered questions, but I found no convincing evidence that Yogananda had relations with women, sexual relations with women, and certainly not that he fathered any child. Nothing that would satisfy an objective observer enough to say, yeah, hate to break it to you, but, sure, you know, yeah, this is the truth. It's just not there. And, you know, of course, people will always believe that their interpretation is correct, and I don't think they'll ever you know, it'll ever be fully known, because you can't ever know what happened in private, you know, 80 or 90 years ago. But I saw no evidence. And for that, I will get angry emails.
But now, you said that...
So anybody listening, please don't send me...
But you just said that it was written about in the newspapers. How did he survive that? How did the work survive?
Well, you know, one of the touching things about digging into his story was the many times when things got really difficult, either because of this or because of financial troubles. Don't forget, you know, he was building his organization, and then the Great Depression happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so, they had to survive in the 30s when, you know, well, you know what the Depression was like. And then the World War II era. So there were great difficulties financially. There were difficulties with, you know, what we've been talking about, various allegations and scurrilous innuendo and overt racism and religious bigotry. He had to deal with all that. And there were times when he said, you know, I don't want to do this. I just want to be close to God, and I'm going back to India, and I'm just going to live the life of what in India is called a sannyasi, to you know, live in a little ashram or go into a cave in the Himalayas and wander the Ganges, just being close to God, and you know, to pursue the higher ideals of the yogic tradition. And he expressed that and was tempted to just give it all up and leave, but he never did. And, you know, he had been charged with a mission from his guru and his guru's guru, and he was going to persist. And that persistence, that perseverance, was very moving to me, and a lesson for all of us of, you know, sacrificing for the a higher good and for a mission. And that, you know, he managed to survive, not just by dint of his own will and resourcefulness, but also that of his followers. I mean, nobody could do this alone, and he had some wonderful people around him who were deeply loyal, hardworking, and resourceful in their own right. And there were key figures who stepped up, and wealthy people who, you know, no guru, no religious or spiritual leader or organization can ever survive without benefactors. And he had them, you know, one in particular that was there to write a check when needed, and who's a love for him and whose development as spiritual beings, you know, was important to him. And they, you know, prevailed upon him to stay and stick it out, and found solutions to all these things. And some of the newspaper stuff and all that, well, that just fades away with the next, you know, headline.
I thought it... In that time, I thought, because, well, it's a lot different from the way it is now, I thought that perhaps it would stick harder back then. But obviously, you're correct, because the legacy of Yogananda continues to live on. And
yeah, and it sticks for a while, and in some people, it would stick forever, and they would, you know, just convince that he was some terrible person, or they would leave... If they were students, and they might just get disillusioned and leave. But that happens all the time to people. And you know, after a while, there's nothing left to write about. So the newspapers will go on to the next subject. And don't forget, some of this occurred during the Depression and the build up to World War II. There were other matters to be writing about.
This is true. This is true. Phil, we are down to the wire for this edition of Common Threads as well. I just want to remind people that they can connect with you and the great things that you do at philipgoldberg.com. That's Philip with one L, as I am reading it, correct?
Thank you. Yes. Yes, and if I can, I'd like to invite them not only, of course, to read the book, but to look at the website. I'm going to be on the road a lot doing public presentations and talks. So if I come to your wherever the listeners are, please come and say hello.
Yeah, and I can attest that Phil gives a wonderful lecture. Well, Philip, I look forward to seeing you at the Whole Foods in West L.A. sometime in the not too terribly distant future, but it's been great to have you this week and last.
Thanks, Fred. It's always a joy to speak to you, and thanks for having me on the show.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Philip Goldberg, our guest today, last week as well, the author of The Life of Yogananda, the story of the yogi who became the first modern guru. This is WGVU-FM.